At 1:45 on a moonless Sunday morning, June 6, 1993, a single police cruiser drove east along that central road, its headlights illuminating the dark asphalt. A large stretch of the peninsula is national parkland, and inside the car, a 28-year-old National Park police officer named David Soma was doing a graveyard shift with his partner, Steve DeVivier. Soma was behind the wheel, and he saw it first. An earlier rain shower had left the ocean swollen with fog, but out to his right, beyond the beach, the darkness was pierced by a single pinprick of faint green illumination. A mast light. The officers pulled over, got out of the car, and scrambled to the top of the dunes separating the road from the beach. In the distance, they beheld the ghostly silhouette of a ship, a tramp steamer, perhaps 150 feet long. The vessel was listing ever so slightly to its side. Soma ran back to the car and got on the radio, alerting the dispatcher that a large ship was dangerously close to shore. He and DeVivier climbed the dune for another look. Then, from out across the water, they heard the first screams. Half stifled by the wind, the cries were borne to them across the beach. To Soma, they sounded desperate, the kind of sound people make when they know they are about to die. He had a flashlight with him and pointed it in the direction of the ship. The sea was rough, the waves fierce and volatile. About 25 yards out, between the rolling swells, Soma saw four heads bobbing in the water. The officers turned and sprinted back to the car. "We've got a large number of people in the water," Soma shouted into the radio. DeVivier had grabbed a life ring and was already running back to the beach. The officers charged into the water. It was cold, 53 degrees, and the surf was violent, big swells breaking all around them and threatening to engulf the people in the distance. Guided by the wailing voices, DeVivier and Soma strode out until they were waist deep. As DeVivier closed the distance to the four people, he hurled the life ring in their direction. But the wind and current carried it away. He reeled it in, walked deeper into the water, and cast the ring again. Again it failed to reach the people as they struggled in the swells. Realizing that they couldn't do the rescue from solid ground, DeVivier and Soma plunged into the water and began swimming, enormous waves twisting their bodies and crashing over their heads. The drowning people writhed in the cold ocean. Eventually, DeVivier and Soma reached them and shouted over the percussive surf, telling them to take hold of the life ring. Then the officers turned around and dragged the shipwrecked strangers back to shore. There the four collapsed, panting on the sand. They were Asian men, the officers saw, diminutive and cadaverously thin. When Soma spoke to them, they didn't appear to understand. They just looked up, with terror in their eyes, and pointed in the direction of the ship. From the ocean, the officers heard more screams. Soma's first radio call to the Park Service police dispatcher had gone out at 1:46 a.m. There was a Coast Guard station just across the peninsula from the beach at the Rockaway end of the Marine Parkway Bridge. Charlie Wells, a tall, ruddy 19-year-old seaman apprentice, was on radio duty from midnight to 4 in the morning. Wells, the son of an emergency medical services captain, had grown up in Whitestone, Queens. He lived in the barracks. He'd been with the Coast Guard less than a year. "A fishing boat sank off Rees Park," a dispatcher's voice said, crackling through the radio. "There's 40 people in the water." Wells ran out of the barracks, started his truck, and drove a few hundred yards south down the access road in the direction of the Oceanside Beach. He pulled over in a clearing and ran up onto the beach, where he was startled by the sight of the ship in the distance. He mouthed a quiet, "Wow." On the beach in front of him, it looked like some madcap game of capture the flag was underway. A dozen or so dark, wiry figures, some of them in ragged business suits, others in just their underwear, were running in every direction, and a number of burly police officers were giving chase. Three off-duty Park Service officers had joined Soma and DeVivier and were scrambling after the Asian men who had managed to swim ashore. "Help!" one of the officers shouted, spotting Wells. Wells took off after one of the men, gained on him easily, and rugby-tackled him. He was much smaller than Wells, skinny and soaked through. Wells held the man down and looked up to see more people emerging from the surf. It was a primordial scene, an outtake from a zombie movie, as hordes of men and women, gaunt and hollow-cheeked, walked out of the sea. Some collapsed, exhausted, on the sand. Others dashed immediately into the dunes, trying to evade the cops. Still more thrashed and bobbed and screamed in the crashing waves. Wells could just make out the outline of the ship in the darkness, There was movement on the deck, some sort of commotion. People were jumping overboard. "We need a Coast Guard boat," one of the officers shouted at Wells, "and a helicopter." Wells ran back to the van and radioed his station. "I need more help," he said. "There's a 200-foot tanker that ran aground right off the beach, and these guys are jumping right into the water." The tide was coming in, and a strong westerly cross current was pulling the people in the water down along the shoreline. The officers ventured into the water again and again. They plucked people from the shallows and dragged them onto the shore. The survivors were terrified, eyes wild, teeth chattering, bellies grossly distended from gulping salt water. They looked half dead. They were all Asian, and almost all men, but there were a few women among them, and a few children. They flung their arms around the officers in a tight clench, digging their fingers so deep that in the coming days the men would find discolored gouge marks on the skin of their shoulders and backs. The night was still so dark that it was hard to locate the Asians in the water. The men relied on their flashlights, the narrow beams roving the waves in search of flailing arms or the whites of eyes. But the flashlights began to deteriorate from exposure to the salt water, and when the lights failed, the rescuers had to wade out into the darkness and just listen for the screams. "We entered the water guided only by the sound of a human voice," one of the officers later wrote in an incident report. "When we were lucky, we could then use our flashlights to locate a person. When we weren't lucky, the voices just stopped." The rescue workers pulled dozens of people to shore. Every time they thought they had cleared the water, another pocket of screams would pick up, and they would head back in. Those who were too tired to walk or move, the officers carried, jackknifed over their shoulders, and deposited on higher ground. There they collapsed, vomiting salt water, their bodies shaking, their faces slightly purple from exposure. The officers tried massaging their legs and arms to improve circulation. Some were hysterical, sobbing and pointing out at the ship. Others seemed delusional and rolled around, covering themselves with fistfuls of sand. Whether to insulate their frozen bodies or hide from the officers was unclear. Some were more collected. They were strong swimmers, or they had caught a generous current. They walked up out of the water, stripped off their wet clothes, produced a set of dry clothes from a plastic bag tied around an ankle, and changed right there on the beach. Some of them then sat among the growing number of survivors on the sand, waiting to see what would become of them. Others simply walked off over the dunes and disappeared into the dark suburban stillness of Breezy Point.